You are tuned in to Community Radio, WPVMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Decreasing cloudiness with temperatures around 67 early, then becoming mostly sunny with a high near 91 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms possible in the afternoon and evening, some of which may be severe, with large hail and damaging winds, and then storms ending tonight with a low near 67. Partly sunny skies on Saturday with a few showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and a high near 89 degrees. I'm meteorologist Angie Kathleen on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is Lynn Burney. Lynn is an executive coach who is based in Paris. She's also the author of 6 books, which she has created over the last 10 years. Lynn and I have known each other since 2006, and I've worked with her off and on over the years. Lynn and I have collaborated on many different levels, and the most intense level we collaborated on was her first book. She asked me to be the book coach for that project, which I happily threw myself into, and she wrote that first book during the COVID period, so there were some really good opportunities for us to interact, even though COVID was on top of us. So this interview with Lynn took place a couple of days ago. I'm now recording the opening in Santa Fe. I'm looking out a window from a friend's house, and I'm petting a big white dog who just came into the room. And so, you know, it's real life. It's really, really a good thing to be alive and to be talking to Lynn. I've known her a long time. So let's turn to that interview now. It opens by Lynn making a reference to the previous visit I made to Paris, which was about a month ago. I was there visiting a friend of mine who has Parkinson's. And Lynn's husband also had Parkinson's and sadly left us last year. So Lynn references that, and then we move forward from there.
We kind of started in on a rather sad state of affairs with your very best friend, John, which of course triggers off all my memories about my husband, Richard, whom you knew. And it sort of triggers off all the very sad parts of my life. But in fact, all those very sad parts have given me 3 extra books. So, you know, there's something very strange about the actual life that I lead and what I've done with that creatively. And you remember how we kicked off with me writing my first book. We don't need to tell that whole story again, but it's a delicious story. I love it. And that led on to my thinking, well, now I know how it works, I'll do another one. So I did 2 memoirs, and then I thought, gosh, I really like doing this. It's time for me to try fiction. But of course, it's never fiction, and we've had that discussion as well. Fiction, you know, what is, if life is one big fiction, then I'm really good at writing fiction. And then I'm waiting for my 4th book to go up online. So they're all self-published. I finished my 5th book, and that covers the subject of Parkinson's and living with somebody with Parkinson's and that person dying. And it's all woven into a story which is completely fictitious, but not quite. And I've now started my 6th book, which is what I was doing in England with my writing buddies, whom you know, Philippe and Chris. Rita was too ill to travel, so she connected with us in the evening in Canada. And I really enjoy that. And I enjoy the fact that it really is my own space that I can step into, thoroughly enjoy myself. There is no pressure on me to produce anything. It's entirely my time, my creativity, me, myself, providing I can afford to keep self-publishing, I'm fine. So I really love doing this. This is what I found that I love most of all.
Well, going back to the time we first started to talk about your first book, and the reason that I'm so very excited about going back to that time, I was watching the Netflix series, Emily in Paris. If you haven't watched it, I encourage you to watch it because it's rather superficial. It's seriously Parisian cliche, and Emily's an advertising executive who's running around Italy and Paris in all the most glamorous settings. Everything is just absolutely exquisite. So I'm watching Emily in Paris and remembering all of those locations that I know so well. And they're probably not that romantic if the day is dreary and it's cold and the wind is blowing. But that's never happening on Emily in Paris. So Emily was sitting there with her possible great love, although we don't ever know if it works out or not. And they're at a table in a train station with white tablecloths and the waiters. And I'm watching Emily in Paris thinking, that's might be exactly the same table Lynn Burney and I sat at when she first started talking about the book she wanted to write. So describe the setting of that restaurant. And then tell us a bit about your thoughts when you were considering the first book. And the reason I'm asking is because now you're on six books, you self-publish, you have no fuss about self-publishing, you're rolling along like you were your own publishing industry. Back then, you were a coach. You weren't a publishing industry. You did love to write, and you really didn't care if anybody read it or not. So tell us about the scene. And what was going on in the very beginning, and we'll dial around to where you are now.
Yeah. Hey, tell me one thing. What I can't remember, I have a distinct memory of you and I being in Smith and Sons on Rue de Rivoli. And I think I also have a memory of you and I at Gare de Lyon in Le Train Bleu, in the coffee part of Le Train Bleu, well before it was, yeah, was it well? I have a feeling it was 2019, but it could have been before. I'm really hazy on that, but I do have a clear picture of you and I sitting at Smith, sitting in the English tea house in Paris on Rue de Rivoli. Do you have that same memory? It wouldn't be white tablecloths, though. So,
well, I don't have the memory of us in the train station. Which train station was it?
It's Gare de Lyon. It's the really big one where there's got this most fabulous restaurant called Le Train Bleu. And back in the day, I mean, before COVID, it was a really good place to meet for business meetings. And that's why the white tablecloth, white tablecloth, that sounds about right. And a really, and all the decor is 19th century, and it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous, Baroque sort of,
you and I did meet at Smith and Sons a fair
we
amount.
Did,
and in fact, a month ago, we sat there for two or 3 hours.
I know. Yeah.
Having chicken pot pie and sipping coffee and tea.
Yeah.
But the train station, that is where we had lunch. It was definitely where we had lunch. Somehow you, and that's the same site where Emily was in
in the series, gorgeous. Of course.
And so I remember you invited me to come to have lunch. I arrived, found the restaurant, and you come to the train station, and the train station is a regular train station. People coming and going, trains leaving, going. I think that takes you out toward Normandy. That's where you catch the train to go out toward Normandy, I believe.
No, that's Saint-Lazare. That's the one that you take to go south to Marseille.
Okay.
That's
where
you go south to. Yeah.
So, and then when I got to the restaurant, I noticed all of the elegance, the old school time warp thing.
That's right.
So you and I sat by at a table that overlooked the courtyard, the big courtyard that's in front of the train station. I remember looking out on the courtyard.
Therefore, we were in the coffee part. We must have been in the restaurant part.
We were in the restaurant part. And
And the reason I'm remembering is because when I saw it in Emily in Paris, I thought, my gosh, that's exactly the vocation. The waiter greeted Emily the same way the waiters greeted us, and the people were busting around. Might have been the same waiters because they worked there forever. And so we sat down and had a 3-hour lunch, at least 3 hours. It was long. And that's when you started talking about maybe, maybe not. Yeah, I might write a book. I don't know. I want to write a book about coaching because I'm a coach and I have a coaching school. So that was where you were. And I don't know. Are you saying that you don't remember that time?
No, I do. Because you know why I do remember? It's because I distinctly remember when I took the decision. It was standing on the steps of the ashram, the place that you know, out in Graz. And I made the statement to a woman whom I've trained as a co-facilitator, as a coach. I've trained her as a coach and now a co-facilitator, blah, blah, blah. And I said to her, I'm going to write a book on clean coaching. And she said, how long will you give yourself? 3 years. It was an absolute definitive statement. It was June 2019. I would have contacted you after that. And then, you know, come the beginning of 2020, and then we have COVID. I mean, the whole world changed basically March 2020. But my grand statement was before Christmas 2019, because after the decision, I would have said, and I'm going to contact James. I know everybody calls you Navi, but I still call you comrade, or I call you James. Okay.
I'm glad to have both. Thank you.
Yeah. And I absolutely know that when I took that decision, I said, right, I can't do this on my own. I need a coach. And that's when I contacted you. And then I realized, what the hell am I talking about?
Well, I remember that I was there in 2019 because my birthday's in November. And my buddy John's birthday is also in November. And often I would come for Christmas time or around our birthdays and celebrate the birthday. So we had that meeting in November around during that 3-week time frame. I was in Paris. And I think I was toward the end of it, and I was getting ready to go back to the States and had the meeting. And then you said, I'll go for this. Yeah. And so that's exactly the right time frame. And then when you dove in, you struggled quite a bit with it.
And that's an understatement.
It rolled through. The work we did rolled. I'd forgotten this, but it rolled through COVID.
It eventually
ended up on the other side of COVID in the book launch party on the river. In fact, I walked by the barge a couple of weeks ago, and I looked down at the bar, I said, there's where Lynn had her book launch. And of course, it's a barge that's attached to the riverbank, and it's a little floating
restaurant. Well,
that was
October, beginning of October 2022.
Yes. Yeah. And I was there for that.
Yeah.
By
that's right. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So go back to your initial thinking around the book and give a little bit of a background for people on what you thought it would be and then what it became, because you knew zero about self-publishing. I mean, you couldn't have been more naive, and I'm using the word ignorant in the best sense of I'm ignorant, so therefore I have many opportunities to learn. You were dramatically ignorant around it, and you knew it, and you were rather happy about it because you thought, well, I can learn a lot. And then you did spend your own money on it. You spent a lot of deep time around this first book. So give us a sense of that. And the reason I'm asking, a lot of people write books and they want to get published, and they try to compete with the agents, get an agent, then get it into the mainstream publishing. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, everybody likes to have a big publisher print a million copies and promote their work around the world.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I haven't experienced that.
Me too.
but the odds of having a book come out in the world are greater if you take the responsibility of doing it yourself. It's the classic DIY, and you were determined. So let's start back at the table that afternoon, and then just give us a sense of where you were. And I will say before you tell the story, and you've already told us this, you're on your sixth book. I mean, now you're driving the train. You did figure it out. You do know what it's like. And you're actually just starting. Six books, just the beginning for you.
Yeah. I was just wondering about that, you know. There is a sense that, gosh, if I'd started earlier, younger, I mean, oh, gosh, maybe I, you know, because the thing is, how many books can you write in a lifetime when you start so late? I don't know. But I just know that I still like doing it, and nothing has happened to destroy the intense pleasure I have creating a book, and understanding how much work goes into it. It's not just the writer. The writer is, you know, it's a third of the task. It's a really an industry, and I really understand why it costs so much to publish a book, and why not everybody, you know, why this dream about being discovered and being having a million copies sold, et cetera, et cetera. It's a real gamble for a publishing house to pick up an unknown writer. Real gamble. How does that happen? If you don't have contacts, if you don't have this incredible stroke of luck, which I guess people dream about, I don't know. But what I absolutely know now is why publishing houses do not pick up every Joe Blow from the street and say, yeah, we'd love to publish you. It costs a fortune. It really does.
Long and short. Go back to the table. I'm trying to get you back to that table for a minute.
I know, you keep resisting it.
You're fighting the question. Yeah. Just set the scene. And I want people to understand how naive you were and how you created a great body of knowledge from being naive. It was a benefit for us to have you be naive.
Yeah. Well, I guess because I've told you this story before, I have a tendency to want to take shortcuts as well. So I'm kind of forgetting that you are interviewing me so that other people can listen to this. But very clearly, I wanted to write the definitive book on clean coaching. I'm the big expert in France, modestly, she said. So therefore, I have lots of things to write. Well, I made so many attempts and I sent you so many paragraphs and pages on clean coaching. I could not find the thread, and I finally bored myself to death. I mean, absolutely bored myself to death. I would never read this in 1,000 years. And I really can't remember what gave me the idea that I could tell the story of my pilgrimage to the tomb of St. James in Santiago, Spain, with my husband, Richard, who wasn't my husband then. But I know the minute I had that idea, I was away, in the sense that, I've got a story to tell. That's what I discovered I liked, telling a story. So, and I found that I could combine my coaching skills by telling this story and completing each section with a series of questions for the reader. And that came naturally because I'm a coach. I'm always asking questions. It's my job. And I found that I ask very good questions because I'm a professional coach. So, and then began the adventure of you getting these pages and giving me feedback on them. And I've never, ever forgotten your question. But what about the reader? Well, I don't give a damn about the reader. I still laugh about that because there were some really amazing moments, and that was one of them when I realized, well, if I'm writing this, I'm writing for a reader. Who's the reader? Oh, and truly that turned the whole thing around for me. And then, I mean, that was my first, it seems to me it was my first big learning was, oh, you actually write for a reader. And that sounds incredibly naive. You're not writing for yourself if you're going to produce a book. I was writing to write a book, tell a story, produce a book, therefore I'm writing for a reader. I mean, I cannot believe how naive I was about that, but that was my first real big awakening.
Well, that's also a strategic question I was asking you. It's perfectly fine to write for yourself. I write my journal all the time for myself. I dictate all the time just for me. I'm not really concerned if anybody ever sees it. That's not the purpose of it. The purpose for me when I am writing for myself is to just give myself a more expanded space to dwell in, to think in, to be at home with me in. And you, when I first met you, 2006, and we first got together out in Normandy with the same crew that you went to England with last month, or Philippe wasn't there, but Chris certainly was. At Jennifer's
house. Well, we first met in a cafe in Paris, you know.
Well, it was at Premier D with Adrian Leach. Yeah, I presented an Imaginative Storm workshop.
That's right.
2006.
That's right.
Adrian booked me and filled up the cafe, and I did my thing, and then off to the races we went. Jennifer DeGant was there. I think Susan Loomis was there. You were there. Yep. Chris might have been
there. Chris was there. Chris was there.
Yeah, yeah. And so and we were all much younger than we are now. Yeah. but so when we went out to Jennifer DeGant's place in 2007, maybe, I don't know, a year later or so.
Something like that, yeah.
You were so excited about writing for yourself, and you loved it so much, and you really, really profoundly did not care if anybody ever read it, and you had no interest at all in being thought of as a writer. You just loved to do it, and you've done it all your life. And the thing I liked about what you wrote was how it appeared geographically on the page. Very precise material. I was like, how in the world does Lynn do that? And that's where you and I started calling each other Comrade L for Conrad Lynn.
Because we
decided, sitting on that bench in the sun, that we were leading some kind of revolution. So we had to have revolutionary names. Now, the revolution never amounted to much. But we still kept the names Comrade L and Comrade J. But as you continued from that time in 2007, I was there a lot over those years. From 2007 on, you and I produced some really large writing workshops in Paris.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
I remember one where we had 30 people showed up. It seemed like it was a big crowd. And we continued on doing that, and also going back out to Normandy a fair amount, and then even smaller ones and work. Like a couple of years ago, we did one, you and Anne and I did one in her office in Paris. And we've done some at Catherine's office in near Champs-Élysées. So it's been really, really good. In the course of when you developed the story of you and Richard going on the journey, tell us about that story. And then I want to move from there to how that launched you into this career of writing for the reader and telling the stories. What was the story? Why was that story so important, your journey with your husband, Richard?
Because it was a learning journey. And it had, because it was a pilgrimage, it had a starting point and an end, like a book. And what I notice with the books that followed is that I actually don't know where they're going to end when I start them. So, but with that one, well, it has to have a finish because the actual pilgrimage has a finish to it. So that was rather reassuring. And what I found was that I was telling it in the first person because it was a memoir. And so then I discovered what it means to write a memoir, which basically is you need to be as truthful as your memory can allow you to be. You know, I was living with Richard, so I could check things against him. But you know what was really amazing? I wrote diaries when I walked. I kept very faithful diary every night. I've lost those diaries, And I only found them when I was cleaning up in January this year. So 2026, I was writing that. I found them after Richard died. And I found them because I thought I was looking at a box of his old photographs, and they weren't. They were my old photographs, and in there, there were the diaries. I just went, whoa, whoa. So I wrote from memory, therefore, as truthful as memory can be, and I found I had to really go into myself and say, what was, it wasn't just walking kilometers, because the walking of the pilgrimage, and when you walk over time, and it was over 4 years, 3 seasons and 10 days, when you walk that amount every day over a period of time, you become emotionally engaged. Physically, you're exhausted, but you're emotionally drained as well. And you meet strange people. And all of that storytelling told 20 years after the event triggered off related memories to when I was a child. And so I was able to weave in anecdotal material from my own life. And I found that I really enjoyed bringing up those that anecdotal material and including them and weaving them with the story. And I liked that weaving because it really was a weaving. But I had a really interesting experience with that. My mother died at the end of 2022. So she never saw the finished book, but she saw a very early chapter because I shared it with her, and she thought it was going to be a travel log. It was going to be me telling a travel log. But in it, at the beginning, I made an anecdotal reference to a childhood incident where I was walking home at night and I was followed by a stranger, of course, a bloke, whoa, yeah, dark winter, la, 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 la. And I told the story of talking to my friend Jesus, and Jesus protected me. And I remembered the story of a woman telling me from the same church I went to that the same thing had happened to her. And she turned around and confronted her follower and said, do you want to pray with me? Well, I was so impressed by that story that I felt very brave walking home at night alone, young. But instead of turning around and saying, do you want to pray with me? I walked into the nearest neighbor's place, knocked on the door, and they invited me in, blah, blah, blah. But when my mother read the story, what she felt was, I was such a bad mother. I didn't protect you. What were I doing, letting you walk around the streets at night? Well, you know, so she thought that I was going to tell a story about how, what a bad mother she was. And that was not what I was doing. But I realized my big learning from that was, even when you're writing a memoir and you're not condemning anybody and you're only as faithful as you can be to your own memories, other people have different memories of the same event. And other people, especially when they're close to you, don't read things in the same way at all. And I realized memoirs are actually quite volatile material. And I realized, well, you have lawyers and things. If you're writing really sensitive material and you're a famous person, then you've got to protect yourself. Now, that's not my case, but I you know, memoir, fiction suddenly felt like a very safe place to be. So memoir, of two books I wrote, my mother felt, ooh, she never got to read it, and I don't think she ever would. And the second book I wrote, memoir, on my brother, oh, my sister didn't feel comfortable with it, and yet I let her read the whole thing. I am eulogious of her, but she doesn't feel comfortable with it. She really doesn't. It's too close. So a memoir, I learned that memory is specific to the person and is as only true as the person can be. And two, it's quite volatile material for other people. And three, fiction is a very safe place to live.
People don't usually say that about fiction. And yet I can see what you mean, because if you're making it up, it certainly hasn't happened in real life, quote unquote.
Yep. Quote unquote. Yeah. 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 So I discovered really interesting thing, writing in the first person and writing in the third person. Now that sounds, you know, hello, yes, writing in the present tense, writing in the past tense. So writing memoir, I was writing in the first person, me, telling a true story. And everything that I've just said. The third book, I had three narrators. I wrote in the first person from three points of view. I wrote as a man, I wrote as a woman, and I wrote as a very young woman. So I wrote from three perspectives. That was really interesting. Really, really, really. I wrote in the past tense. And with the fourth book, I wrote in the third person. And I only wrote, and I therefore I had a narrator's voice, but it was pretty much coming from the main character's perspective. That was interesting, really interesting. And the one I'm writing at the moment is, I started writing it in the third person, and I wondered what would happen if I wrote in the first person. And I changed it. The first three pages, I changed to first person. I thought, yeah, I like that. So I'm writing fiction in the first person in this sixth book. It's interesting.
As you've moved along over these books, have you been aware of the learning changes that have happened to you, or have they been so incremental that suddenly one day, oh, you notice them, but you're not quite sure when they emerged?
Oh, no. I really clearly made a decision for book three. It was going to be fiction because I wanted to tell my story of my own hippie days in the 70s, but I wanted to disguise it. So it's a weaving of my diaries from the 70s and traveling overland through Asia and of that character. Me as a young woman, but I've made it. I know what's true. I absolutely know what's true. And my characters are based on real people, but they've been worked. So why am I telling you all that? I clearly remember thinking, I want to tell this story. I really do, but I can't tell it as a memoir. I can't. I don't want to. I want to tell it. If I'd just written the diaries, you know, boring, hello, and then we did this, and then we did that, and then we did this, and it would have been a travel log. So I didn't want that. So I really, that was my first attempt. Okay, how do you tell a story that is true and not true? How do you, and then I got into, I actually wrote the last part first, because Philip, you know, my writing buddies, Philip said, what would happen if you found those diaries in your cellar? I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. So I started with a discovery by the daughter of my main character discovering the diaries. And then I go, oh, yeah, on Madison Bridge, was it? Madison Bridge with Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood?
The Bridges of Madison County.
The Bridges of Madison County. And I know that that's the way that started. And I thought, okay, that really worked in cinema. And it's an easy device. And so what I'm trying to tell you is, hang on 2 seconds. Hang on. Michelle Monnier calling, but I'm just going to, can I call you later? Voila. What was I saying then? Oh yeah, device. So what I was now thinking on book three was, how do you use devices to tell your story? So what device? And that's when you, I'm pretty sure that was the conversation we had where you said, well, you've got to have air cons. How many air cons have you got falling out of the windows? You are wicked.
Well, that's not me. That's a classic device. But it's so people forget when they're writing, if they want to pull the reader along, they need to toss an air conditioner out the window or something has to happen.
I know.
The dog has to come out and bark at them. Some obstacle has to appear. And the reason that's the case, we are all so used to watching these terrific TV series, Netflix, other HBO.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing that the people who aren't in the business of generating content like we are, you might watch a Netflix series and think, I wonder who wrote that script. Gee, that's so smart. Look how well they did. And there are plenty of prize winning series out there. Breaking Bad would be one of them. Homeland would be another. There's a wonderful one out of Canada called Heartland. It's a vanilla show. Everybody wins in the end. It's about a ranching family and it's well written, and they have the little dramas that happen where air conditioners drop out of the window, the horse gets sick, or somebody, every now and then somebody dies, which pushes the whole story along. These stories are written by super smart writing groups. So 15 mm-hmm. people will be in a room generating the story. That's why they're so compelling. They're throwing dozens of air conditioners out the window. And so we're competing as writers and storytellers. In a sense, we're competing with that training that everybody's had to have the cliffhanger, to have the action happen, and somebody has to deal with it.
That was really my learning in book three. Was about rhythm, narrator, but the air cons, I really think it was book four when I really went for the air cons. It's just, when I think about it, it's kind of insane. But it's I really get that, because I'm now reading books completely differently from the past. I'm really looking at, why does this reader keep me reading, turning the pages? Why is this one boring me? But why am I reading it anyway? So I have a whole lot of questions now about when I'm reading another writer, which I did not have before. So I'm reading differently as a result of writing.
Do you think you'll look back on this series of six books that you've worked on as building some kind of foundation that's leading you to territories you have yet to even know exist?
Well, good question. I don't know. I must admit that the subject material for books 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 were clear and obvious for me. I absolutely knew what I wanted to write about in book 3, 4, and 5. Book 6, what do I want to write about? And I was sitting, this is what's interesting for me. This is the difference. This is really the difference with book 6. I was sitting in Rue Saint-Florentin in a Japanese tea house in the middle of April. And I looked up, looked through the window, and I saw a guy looking in. And I imagined it was my then dead husband, Richard. And then I thought, gosh, what a great beginning for a book. And I quickly wrote it down on my telephone. And I thought, I really like that. So I did a whole description of the matcha, latte matcha, the matcha latte, the Japanese, special Japanese spring little patisserie, which is bean paste and gorgeous, 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 blah, blah, blah. Did all that. And then I thought, well, no, it's not Richard. It's a guy called Seb. I really like that name. Who the hell is Seb? And so then I started engaging with my imagination, which you know all about because of the imaginative storm, right? And that's when I came back to the imaginative storm, because I actually found by doing what we call the crazy little Saturday exercises, started loosening up things. And this time, the difference is this time, I am truly telling a fictional story. Okay, the settings are Paris, the people I know and can elaborate on, and I've given them pasts and everything like that. But I'm not calling upon my own deep personal experience of life. I'm writing fiction for the first time in book six. I mean, real made up stuff.
We are looking at a time frame, an arc that started when I met you, 2006, and you were writing, but you hadn't officially given yourself the green light to step into exploring what it means to learn how to do it. So yeah. You've actually been focused on this since I met you. So
yeah,
that was 2006, and now we're in 2026. Has that been 20 years?
It hardly
more.
Seems possible. Yeah, it hardly
it
seems possible,
been.
But yeah.
And what I love about this conversation, in the course of the 20 years, the fuel that's pushed you forward has been your commitment to yourself, not to anybody else, just commitment to Comrade L and her own revolution with Comrade L, right? And now you've arrived 20 years later, and you're not retired from your coaching business, but you've moved into having two career threads.
And yeah, well, one has to pay for the other, huh?
One pays for the other. That's true. The coaching pays for the books, and you're committed enough so that you're willing to pay for it.
Yeah,
and so I mean, it's an encouraging story, but the main thing to me that makes the story work is that you decided to do it and you stuck with it.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it for identity marker purposes. You did it because you had questions you were driven to answer for yourself. And it took me a long time to get you to realize that if you wanted people to read it, you had to like think about the other people, which you actually ended up, you finally understood that. But there was a while when you just could not care less.
You know, come on, you remember your wonderful phrase to me when you said, you can write 14 pages about the funeral. Nobody's going to read it, but you can write it. And I thought, oh, my God.
Well, you had done that. You had written 14 pages.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm like, okay, just just get over it. Put your brother in the ground and cover him up and go do something else, for God's sakes. Let's as we move toward our little bit of time we have left together, maybe 10 more minutes or so, touch on the financial commitments one has to make, the business part of this, and what you've done in order to make that happen, just so people who want to do this have a strong basis for where they can move forward on.
Well, I cannot not tell the story of the first choice, because I had, and I'm not going to name names, but I had clearly two choices of working with a self-publishing house in Oxford, England, or working with a self-publishing company in the States. And the difference in price was radical. I mean, the one in the States was at least three times more expensive than the one in Oxford. And I had no criteria for recognizing why would anybody pay that amount when you could have the same thing for a third of the price. And it just felt insanely different. And I remember we had this conversation and you were present for both the conversations with both self-publishing houses, blah, 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 blah. And I finally did a coaching session with our very good friend, Jennifer de Gaunt. And I came away from that conversation with one phrase: they deserve the best. Now, don't laugh, but they were the readers, not me. The readers deserve the best. And with that clarity, I thought, well, I'm going to go the whole hog. I'm going to invest, and I can put numbers on that. We're talking about $10,000 the first time. And I had a first class, your neighbor, Janet Byrne, you know, world class editor, the first for my first book. How incredible is that? That's thanks to you. But nevertheless, the whole thing cost, you know, $10,000 to start with, which that sounds sounded insane. And it probably was, but I got the best. And I was so happy to have that book, to look at it and to feel proud of it. It was like, you know, this beautiful baby. Look, isn't it just gorgeous? And I was proud to hold it up, to send it to people, blah, blah, blah. And the same team has worked with me on book 2, 3, 4, and 5. And the same team means my project manager, Jennifer Sanders, and my designer, Christina Teal, who lives in New Zealand. And the editor has changed each time. I've never had Janet Byrne again, but then it was memoir to begin with, and now I've moved into fiction, and I don't think Janet really, that's not really her cup of tea, is it, really?
Well, just to give a frame for Janet, she is the next-door neighbor here in Taos in the area where I live. Janet is the only editor Michael Lewis will work with, and Michael Lewis wrote The Big Short. He's been around for a long time. And another name that people might recognize, recently Ezra Klein, the editor at the New York Times, wrote a book on abundance, and Janet edited Ezra Klein's book. And she also was the main editor for the Planet Money book, which came out as well. And then she also edited, of the many books she's edited, Nancy Pelosi's book was one that she edited. So these are all prominent people. And Janet does not have a snooty bone in her body. I mean, honest to God, she really does it.
She was so kind to me.
And she did take you on. But Janet charged, like, she charges between, for a small book, $4,000, for a big book, Ezra Klein book would be, or other books that are big, up to $15,000 to edit them. Yeah. Now, it is the best. Yeah. So you do have to pay for the best. And that's what I loved about what you did. You were willing to pay for it. And indeed, tell us what the result was.
Well, I need to say, first of all, that I am so indebted to that decision and the people I met and the result that I got that I, you know, thank you. That, Lynn, was a very good decision. It goes with what my mother always said. You get what you pay for. You pay for quality, you get quality. Voila. It's as simple as that. So the result was a beautiful design, a clear inner design, excellent editing. I learned so much from that first editing job. I basically learned how a book gets published. In that first book, I learned what editing was. It's not red lines through everything. It's a person with highly developed skill set who wants the best for your book. Now, that's a whole new mindset. We're not at school. Somebody's not going to destroy your book. They're actually going to make it the best possible book that you can produce at that time in your life. And that's what Janet did. That's what Jennifer did. That's what Christina did. They helped me do the best that I could do at that time in my life. And I'm still proud of the story. I think it's a good story.
Yeah, and you fought a good battle with the need to be the coach and to tell the coach story. And then you realized that you didn't actually lose the battle. You won the game because you had the insight regarding the direction you needed the whole thing to go. So it ended up, you know, once a pilgrim, always a coach is the title of the book. And so you went back to your coaching. But I remember when we were developing it, I was actually learned a lot from Janet as well, because I never thought of myself as an editor, never even thought of it as an editor. And then when you turned the book into Janet, Janet came to me. She said, well, who did the developmental editing on this?
Yeah, you
and
did.
I said, well,
yeah,
I'm the only did. One that was there. And she said, my yeah. God, that's yeah. fantastic. And I'm like, Janet Burns said, I was a good developmental editor. I was very like a little kid. But yeah. one of the things yeah, people don't did. Understand
yeah.
when they're trying to generate a book or a story, yeah. that editing process starts before yeah. you even write with all yeah. the powerful
you have a conversation.
Questions you have to
Yeah. You remember what you did for book four? I'm not going to name names again, but you clearly said, well, you can have that as a Muslim family, but you're going to run a few risks if you do. So, I mean, you were really helpful in giving me some really good tips, and you were also helpful on. What appears to be small things, but they're actually major. In other words, if you're quoting things, copyright issues, I mean, you know a lot about books, publishing, writing yourself. It's not just about the creativity. You also know a lot about the industry. And you also have some amazing contacts. I mean, they're all your contacts that got my first book going. That's because of you. So I'm, I bow down to the way you've walked beside me, right from the beginning. I really do.
Well, it's amazing. You're one of the few people I've encountered over the years, and I've written with a lot of people. I've been in the poetry world. I enjoy writing, and I think one of the reasons you and I get along is because my motivation is the same as yours. I'm not particularly trying to be a professional writer. I just like communication. And if it happens to appear on the page, all the better. Great. If somebody reads it, bravo for all of us. So but I do enjoy working in a collaborative situation, moving something forward and exploring it. And I've learned a lot, and I do have a lot of knowledge, which we're coming to the end of this. But what I, in closing, I think one of the things I have witnessed with you and myself also, I'm not as inclined to discount my knowledge as I once was. I realize what I know. And I've never thought of you as you're not particularly inclined to discount Comrade L. Lynn Burney. You have a pretty good self-esteem show going on. That said, when you realized you could write for the audience, you were willing to let the stakes go up, and then you started exposing more of yourself, the interior of you, sharing the intimacy of you with readers. And we both learned how important that is to fully acknowledge our range rather than to keep it under wraps.
Yeah, there is that. And I would add to that I love the British understatement. I really learned in book five, show and not tell. I hope, it hasn't been edited yet. So I'm waiting to get, an editor on the job to see whether I really have learned that. How much depth you actually reveal through showing and not telling. That's what really interests me in book five, because it was essentially the story of my husband's dying, but it's all wrapped up in fiction and storytelling. And I know what I was working on was that journey for me. And I'm going to feel a little upset here. Excuse me a minute. Oof. Yeah, I was very much working through that. And putting that down in a story form, as you know, because of your friend John and Parkinson's, you know that that's a really hard journey.
It's a very, very difficult journey, no doubt about it. And Richard is no longer with us.
No.
And thus the tears that you have right now. And what I love about the work you're doing, and we can close with this. I like it that you're willing to be a little messy for us, just to say there's a lot of range involved in this business of storytelling, and you're willing to explore the range wherever it takes you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And some people do it through painting, like my sister. I do it through words. And so do you.
Well, Lynn Burney, Comrade L, thanks for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
And there you go, my friends, my conversation with Lynn Burney. And Lynn and I have been talking for over 20 years, so I've enjoyed every encounter with her and look forward to many, many more. So this brings us around to the close of our show. I'd like to thank you for listening to this conversation. And if you've tuned in before, listening to the other conversations as well. I really do appreciate it. I do bump into people in Taos and in Asheville who tell me they've heard the show. It's always a bit of a heartfelt good feeling when somebody compliments me on what they've heard or tells me something they'd like for me to do that I haven't done yet. So I do appreciate you listening. And I would like to also thank Devine Dial for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville, and Robin Collier and Mike Tilley for doing the same with KCEI Cultural Energy Radio in Taos, New Mexico. I air this show on both those stations before I put it online, so I'm thrilled to be associated with community radio. I'd like to thank Walter Parks for our theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. I would like to say, if you'd like to reach me, nave@jamesnave.com. Always available. Love to have an email from you. If you're interested in joining me for my regular collaborative work with Allegra Houston, our Imaginative Storm writing prompt of the week, Circle Gathering, it's always happening on Saturday between 12 and 1 p.m. It's on Zoom. It's easy to access. We would love to have you. JamesNave.com if you'd like to join us and test it out. See what you think. We only generate a piece of writing for a short period of time. 10 minutes is all it takes, but we do spend an hour visiting, and it's great fun. So there you go. I think that pretty much covers it all for now. Thanks again for being part of the show, joining me, tuning in, all of that stuff. I really appreciate it, and I'd like for you to come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
And I hope it's similar to the joy you have on listening to it. Is I get to go through 500, 600, maybe 1,000 songs, just listen for a few seconds, just flip through them real quick. But what a privilege, what a joy. It's like something that royalty would get. You get to listen to 500 new songs a week. And the fact is, anybody can do that. But I never thought it was possible. I just never thought of it. But really, anybody can do that at any time. Most music these days, you can hear it on the internet. And just take a little bit of time and flip through a bunch of songs. You don't have to listen to the whole thing, just listen a little bit. And the best part about it is a lot of commercial entities channel you into a certain kind of music. They have what they call predictive algorithms. It's just top 40 radio all over again. Here, this is the kind of stuff you like. We'll give you a whole bunch of it. And we'll keep repeating it over and over again because, that's where all the money is. But this station says, let's do different things. Let's listen to music you've never heard before. And let's not repeat it. It's a joy, isn't it? Thank you for joining. Thank you for being part of this.
Five names that I can hardly stand to hear, including yours and mine and one more chip who isn't here. I can see the ladies talking how the times are getting hard, and that fearsome excavation on Magnolia Boulevard. Yes, I'm going insane, and I'm laughing